Before we begin this morning's shiur, I'd like to just mention two dedications. This morning's shiur is dedicated by Corey and Ariella Kamen as a schus for Eloi Hanashama for their grandmother, whose shloshim was yesterday, Gittel Bas Tzvi, as well as by Marilyn Cutler as a schus refuah shlema for David Yehuda ben Leah. We wish him a refuah shlema bekarov besoch sha'ar chole Yisrael. So we hope that our Divrei Torah will be a merit for both David Yehuda ben Leah, as well as Gittel Bas Tzvi. So I got a lot of feedback from last week's shiur that the members of our shiur wanted that I should just continue what I did not have an opportunity to finish off last week. So that's what we're going to do. And in doing so, I just wanted to begin with something that is relevant to this week's parsha, but it will bring us back to the story of the Dubna Magid as well. The Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah a fascinating story about Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. So we're told that Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, one of the great Tanoim, was confined. He was bedridden. And the Gemara tells us that Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, one of his contemporaries, went to visit him. And he walks in to visit his teacher, to visit his Rebbe, and he says, "You know, I don't understand. You're my Talmud, you're my student, and I thought I gave over to you all the values of life and all the right way to live, and I don't understand the decision that you have made. I've heard, people have told me, that you are being makil kihilos barabim, that you are teaching Torah in the public square. You are not afraid at all. Don't you know that there is a powerful army against us? Don't you know that now we are living through a time of genocide, of extermination of the Jews? And they have made a decree that nobody's allowed to teach Torah, so aren't you afraid? I don't understand how you bring yourself to do such a thing." And he looks at his teacher and he says, "I understand what you're saying, but min ha-shamayim yirachamu. They'll look after me." And his teacher, Rabbi Yossi, turns back to him and he says, "I'm asking you a good question, and you're responding by saying, God's going to look after me? You're being irresponsible. What do you mean God's going to look after you? You are looking toward giving up your life." And he says, "Look, you know, if I'm going to be Moser Nefesh, it may as well be for this. And I understand that I'm risking my life, but this is a worthy cause." So he turns to his Rebbe, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. He says, "You know, let's pick up from where you left off. You said that I'm going to lose my life because I'm doing something very dangerous. And maybe they're going to catch me and they're going to prosecute me." He says, "I have a question. Do you think I'm going to go to Olam Haba? Like, if that's what you think is going to happen to me, I'm curious. Am I righteous? Do you think maybe I'll have an opportunity to be in Olam Haba?" And his Rebbe says, hey, hold on a second. We have to think about that. Did you ever do anything in your life to deserve Olam Haba? Let's try to think about that." And he's thinking and he's racking his brain trying to figure out, did I ever do anything in my life to deserve Olam Haba? And he finally comes to the conclusion, yes, I did once do something. Pam nischalfu li mo shel tzedakah b'mo shel purim. You see, I had two different accounts in my bank. One was set aside for the money that I was going to spend on celebrating Purim, and the other one was set aside to give to charity, to give to people who were in need, and they got mixed up for whatever reason, and I couldn't figure out which one was which, and I decided, you know what, I'm just going to give up on the money, I'll put it all to charity, I'll pay for the Purim Suda on my own, and whatever loss I take, I'll take for myself, it's okay. So Rebbe turns to him and he says, wow, that's an amazing story. If that really happened, then I am jealous of the portion in the world to come that you will have. That's really just an unbelievable story. And I'm so overwhelmed by what I'm hearing. I hope, mechelkecha yehi chelki umegoralecha yehi gorali. I hope someday that I'll be as lucky as you to get a portion in the world to come the same or similar to the one that you have, because this is just an amazing story. Now, how do you understand that? This is a very troubling story. First of all, who are we talking about? We're describing an individual who is willing to give up his life al Kiddush Hashem. He's standing in the middle of a public square teaching Torah at a time when there was a decree against the Jewish people that they were not allowed to do that. He does it because he believes that the cause is worthwhile. He does it because he believes that he has to show the Jewish people that Torah will never be forgotten, that we will never give up. So of course he's going to Olam Haba. What kind of question is that? And when he's asked this question, the only answer he can give is, hey, you know, many years ago, something happened, and the truth is, a couple of dollars got mixed up, $25, $50, and I was willing to give it up to charity, to give it up to tzedakah. I don't know, maybe I'll be in Olam Haba. His Rebbe says, wow, that's amazing. I'm just, you know, your kindness, your generosity, your benevolence is just amazing to me. Really? He's so amazed. What's so amazing? It seems to pale in comparison to what he's doing now. And not only that, we have an amazing Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Not what we're up to now. I don't even know where we're up to. We're digressing for a couple of weeks or months. So the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos in the sixth parak that one time, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, now notice, the same person, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, who's the Rebbe here, who's just admiring this incredible generosity of his students. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma was once traveling, and somebody bumps into him and he says, "Are you the famous Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma?" He says, "Yes, I am." "Well, you know, the problem is in our community we need a rabbi. Would you be interested in coming, moving to our community?" He says, "No, I'm very comfortable where I am. I really am not interested in relocating." So they have to up the ante, and they start negotiating with him. And they say, "How about if we gave you a couple of $1 million? Would you come and be the rabbi?" He says, "No." "How about if we gave you tens of millions of dollars? Would you come and be the rabbi?" He says, "No. Eini dar ela b'makom Torah. Your place is not a place where I can grow. It's not something where I feel I can accomplish. And it's not where I belong." And he is insistent that he stays where he is. He gives up on millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, and he says he will not leave because it is not a place of growth. Now, this is Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, who had no problem giving up on tens of millions of dollars for a position that he could have easily had. And yet, he is overwhelmed by the generosity of spirit of his student, who gave a couple of dollars to charity when it got mixed up with something else. How do you understand this story? Perhaps the answer is as follows. Reb Chaim Friedlander writes in the Sefer Sifsei Chaim, in the name of Rav Dessler, his Rebbe, that the answer is, sometimes when we live life, we tend to notice things and we give attention to the things that are most obvious to us, to things that are outstanding. You know, you see advertisements all the time, and the way they catch our eye is by saying, "This is going to be the best and the greatest and the biggest ever, and we're going to accomplish such big things together." Why don't they say we're going to accomplish small things? Maybe we'll do something together? No, because that doesn't sell. Nobody's interested. I just had somebody who emailed me yesterday. They want to make a Shabbos here in the shul with an organization. "You have no idea. We're going to accomplish big things together." I said, "I'm curious. What kind of big things do you have in mind?" "I have lots of things in mind, not with you, but I have lots of things in mind. I'm curious, what kind of big things do you have in mind? Why can't you say we're going to have a wonderful Shabbos together and maybe we'll inspire one person over Shabbos and that's already a big thing to me?" Maybe. But that doesn't sell. Nobody's interested. So Reb Chaim Friedlander explains that sometimes we overlook and we disregard something that we think is not worth our consideration. My father says over all the time, the Rav Soloveitchik used to tell the students who were just getting smicha and going out into the rabbinate, don't mistakenly think, don't develop a Messiah complex. Don't think that your being in the rabbinate is going to make every family Shomri Shabbos when you're living in a community where no one was. And don't think that every single child in your community is going to go to Jewish day school. And don't think you are going to change the entire world. And as a result of your thinking in such a way, you think, I can cut corners here, I can cut corners there, this halacha is not so important, that one is not so important, all of them are negotiable because, after all, look what I'm doing. Don't think that way. What he warned the students was, it's important to keep in mind, if you get one family to keep Shabbos over the course of 50 years in the rabbinate, that's already something that's valuable, that's already something that's worth your time. And don't worry about the fact that there are 1,000 other families that you have not been able to convince, that you have not been able to inspire. It's good that you did something. And that is something very significant. And that, says Rav Dessler, is what this is all about. Sometimes people are involved in something, and you never know what motivation they have. Can you imagine the newspapers of that generation were writing about Rav Chanina ben Tradyum? Look at this unbelievable Jew who was willing to stand out in the middle of the public square, and he's willing to give his life al Kiddush Hashem. Can you imagine how much publicity he got? Can you imagine how good he must have felt? Now, obviously, we probably have to imagine that he did it for the right motives. But what his Rebbe was asking him was, did you ever have an opportunity in your life where you did something that nobody else other than you and God were aware of? That nobody else will ever find out about? That really didn't make such a big difference? And you could have gone this way, you could have gone that way, but you decided on your own to do the right thing. Just because you're a good person. That's the ticket to Olam Haba. The ticket to Olam Haba is not the big ticket items that make a big splash that everybody hears about. Let's see, did you ever do anything in your life that changed, that impacted the life of someone else, even slightly, and made it just a little bit more positive? And he thinks for a moment, and he says, yes, actually. One time I had a private moment between me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nobody else was involved. Nobody else will ever know about it. A couple of dollars got mixed up, and I decided to do the right thing. And Rabbi Yossi says, that's how I know that you're a Ben Olam Haba. It's relevant to this week's parsha because he says, you look in Parsha Shemos and you notice that there are two absolutely amazing women. One of them is Shifra, one of them is named Pua, and the Torah describes how they defied, how they ignored the plan of Paru. They thwarted all of his ideas. He said, every young child that is born should be thrown into the river, and they chose not to do so. Not only that, Vatechayena Sayiladim. The Torah says that they went out of their way to give life to the children, not just to allow them to come into the world and to help the mothers during the birthing process, but even after the child was born, they sat there and provided for the children as well. Now you think about that. Why are their names Shifra and Pua? Who were these women? Rashi tells us these were the two most prominent, most celebrated, most distinguished members of the generation. This was Miriam and Yocheved. Can you imagine? The Gemara says that they had a level of prophecy that was higher than the Gadol HaDor. They were responsible for saving the entire generation. And yet, a woman like that, who is involved in such amazing work on behalf of the Jewish people, goes down in history as Shifra and Pua. Why are they called that? Rashi says the reason why is because Shifra Shemeshaperas Asavla, because she used to sit there and put cream on the children's skin to make sure it was soft. And Pua, that she used to sit there and coo the children when they were crying. That's the way you refer to the most distinguished members of the generation? Does that make sense? How do you understand that? And Rav Dessler says, yes, that is the greatest tribute to a person. They can be the greatest human being. They can have a very prominent position in the Jewish community. But let's see, how much do they pay attention to details? How much does it matter to them when a young child is crying, when a young child is underprivileged, and they have the opportunity to be there and to help them, and yes, to soothe their skin and to calm them down when they are alone, and to give them opportunities that they otherwise will not have? That is the greatest tribute to a person. I think about it all the time. Rabbi Feiner once made this observation to me. Every book that you read about a Gadol B'Yisrael really is the same. What happened? They were born. Obviously, when they were born, the house lit up, of course. No? Amazing. If the house did not light up when your children were born, I guess your kids will not be Gadol B'Yisrael. Don't be turned off. So, probably not true, but that's what they write. The house lit up. By the time he was 2.5, he finished all of Shas. Kid didn't know how to read yet. But of course, finished all of Shas when he was 2 years old. By the time he was finished with high school, he didn't take a second for himself. Every Monday and Thursday he was fasting. Amazing, right? They tell these amazing stories. And what happens after that? So then he turns 15. And now he's an adult. And he gets married when he's 18 or 20. And from that day on, he made a deal with his wife that he's going to learn forever and ever. And that's what he did. And he sat in his corner. You've seen such stories? Sounds familiar. So what's the difference? Why should I read another one of these? They're all the same. They're all the same made-up story, right? We know that this is not how great people become great. I always mention, when I speak to high school students, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was born, his mother did not call him Moshe Rabbeinu. She gave him a name at his bris. His name is Moshe. She actually didn't. Someone else did. But they didn't call him Moshe Rabbeinu. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was not referred to as such, and neither was the Rambam. All of these personalities grew throughout their lives to become the people who they were, and the leadership that they gave over to our generation and to our community is something that is legendary, but it's something that they built on their own. So, I mention this because here you have... Why do I mention this? What was I just talking about? The book, yes, thank you. So, every book is the same. So what makes this personality different than the other? Why is this one more interesting to read than the last one I read? And Rabbi Feiner pointed out to me, the answer is because it's the small details of their lives that make them unique. Let's hear the story about how they interacted with the poor person who was outside of their home. Right? Something I was so moved. Rabbi David Feinstein passed away just recently. It was such an amazing story that I read about him. There are so many great stories about lots of great people, but just something that showed a sense of character of who he was. So there's somebody, I think he's from West Hempstead, who runs a magazine over the summertime, and he interviews all kinds of people and asks what I believe are very strange questions. So I've gotten his email sometimes. Can you please answer the following questions? And I never respond because I'm not interested. And the questions are, if you had an opportunity to bring back anyone from the dead, who would you want to talk to? If you spent 5 minutes at a Shabbos table with anybody, who would it be? I don't care for such questions, so I ignore them. But Obviously, Reb David Feinstein was a much nicer person than I am, so he responded. The guy asked him questions, so he answers. So he asked a lot of people. He asked 25, 30 people, what would you do if you had an opportunity to bring anyone to your Shabbos table? Anyone from all the history of the Jewish people, who would it be? So somebody said Moshe Rabbeinu, and somebody else said Rashi. I have so many questions. And somebody said Avraham Avinu. I want to ask him about the Akedah and this. Everyone had an idea. Reb David Feinstein responded, I would go onto the street and pick the first three poor people that I see who don't have a meal. I would bring them into my house. It's amazing. So why was he a gadol? He was a gadol because he knew so much Torah? No. Lots of people know lots of things. He was a gadol because when you give him a chance to choose anybody who he would like to have at a Shabbos meal, the answer that he gives is, without flinching, of course, I would just go onto the street and pick the three poorest people that I can find who don't have a meal, and I would provide for them. What else would I do? Think I care to meet Moshe Rabbeinu? It's nice. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to help people out. That's what makes people unique, is the small details of their lives, the decisions that they make that really impact others. The Yalkut Shimoni has an unbelievable comment, and it's like you shudder when you hear this comment. In Parshas Mishpatim, quotes a pasuk, V'ish trumos yeharsena. So it's a pasuk from Mishlei, I believe, where the Navi tells us, V'ish trumos yeharsena, you have a person who is trumos, who is making such major contributions to the world, but yeharsena, he destroys the world. So how do you have such a person? If you're making such major contributions, how can you also be so destructive? Look at the recent news coming out of Israel, and you can understand sometimes you have people who are contributing very heavily, positively to society, and at the same time they can be heavily destructive and bringing horror to the world. You never know. But the Medrash here refers to a different kind of personality. Listen to what the Medrash says. Zeh ha-chacham. What is this a reference to? Zeh ha-chacham shehu yodea halachos medrashos ve'agados. This is a big Talmud Chacham who knows everything there is to know. He knows all of Shas. He knows halachos medrashos ve'agados. You ask him a question, he knows the answer. He's an amazing person. And yet, that same person, Yasam ve'almana holfen etzlo sheyasa din beinehen. One fine day, he's sitting in his study preparing a shir, and a Yasam ve'almana knock on the door and say, you know, we have a neighbor who's taking advantage of us. We have a neighbor who isn't really acting properly, and we need to have a din Torah. We need to sit down. He stole money from us. He took away some of our property. He moved over the property line. And this man says, Asuk ani b'mishnasi. I'm too busy. I'm preparing a shir. I don't have time for this. I think I have time for this nonsense. Couple of dollars he took from you, really? Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Amar Lo HaElokim, listen to this, Mala ani alecha ki'ilu hichrafta es ha'olam. I consider you like a person who just destroyed the world. I don't care for any of your learning. I'm not interested in your Torah contributions. It's worth nothing. If you can't find a space in your heart to figure out how to have empathy and compassion for the Yasam ve'almana who come to you and they feel that you can be helpful, what good are you? I need all of your knowledge. I need all of your years of Torah study. It doesn't help me. It doesn't advance the cause of the world. And that's an amazing comment of the Medrash. But again, it points to this very same idea. The Medrash tells us in Parshas Bo, when Yitzias Mitzrayim happened, and now we're describing the beginnings of that story, so the Medrash says, ultimately, how were the Jewish people saved? So they were told that they should take a little blade of grass, dip it into the ground, dip it into a big pool of blood, and then they should take that and put it over the doorpost. Writes the Medrash, Ha'ezov nira la'adam she'eno klum. A blade of grass is so insignificant to all of us. We don't pay attention. How many people walk by a blade of grass or a leaf from a tree, pull it off, rip it out of the ground? Doesn't mean anything. No one pays attention. But writes the Medrash, V'kocho gadol lefnei ha'elokim. A blade of grass has tremendous value in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. After all, that's what saved the Jewish people. In the times of Yitzias Mitzrayim, it was all the blade of grass. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught us on that occasion that we need to pay attention to the blades of grass in our lives. We need to think about the small things that so often are overlooked, that people do not give enough attention to. Greatness can be found not in the big, exciting moments of life, but sometimes in the small actions and the small perspectives that we have, thinking deeply about how it is that we can enhance the lives of others, even in a very small way. I mention this because, as we know, last week we had a lot of discussion about the Dubna Magid. So he has a comment on Parshas Ekev. Torah tells us, "V'haya ekev tishmuun es hamishpatim ha'ele." Parsha Sekev begins by telling us, "Ekev tishmuun," which is a very curious, a very unusual word, and that has caught the attention of many of the Mefarshim throughout the generations. Most famously, Rashi explains, what does it mean when the Torah says, yes, it's freezing in here. What does it mean when the Torah says, "V'haya ekev tishmuun"? So Rashi explains what it's referring to is mitzvahs she'adam dash be'akava. Not doing a good enough job to warm people up. I don't know. Sorry. So Rashi says from the Medrash, it's referring to mitzvah she'adam dash be'akavav. That there are certain mitzvahs that we look at and we say, it's trivial, it's insignificant. It's not as critical in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Pasuk here tells us that we have to make sure, ekev tishmu'un, even those mitzvahs that we think may not be so important. God will look the other way. It's really not from the most cardinal sins that I can violate. This isn't the most fundamental mitzvah in all the Taryag. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ekev tishmu'un. Make sure you look into those mitzvahs that many people are trampling over, that many people are not paying attention to. So there's a beautiful mashal of the Dubna Maggid to explain this. He says there was once a wealthy individual who decided that he wanted to buy a beautiful tablecloth. He was having a big event, a big affair in his house, and they didn't have tablecloth gemachs like we have today, so he had to buy a very expensive piece of fabric. So he goes to the fabric industry, wherever it is, to the district, and he starts looking around at all these beautiful designs, and he asks the owner of the store, how much would it cost for a couple of yards of this fabric? It looks like such a beautiful fabric. And he says that it would cost, $1,000. I know it's expensive, but I think that you'll like it. I think it will be perfect for your affair. And he decides to buy it. Now, the owner of the store tells him, I appreciate the fact that you bought it, but let me just give you a piece of advice. This is raw fabric. I mean, it could be used the way it is, but I'm just giving you advice. You should probably go to a seamstress, to a tailor, and have the bottom hemmed so that this way the strings aren't coming out at the edges. So he says, I don't understand. I just paid $2,000 or $3,000 for this piece of fabric. You're going to tell me I have to go now to the tailor and pay another $150 to have it tailored? Does that make sense? Are you telling me that your fabric is deficient? Are you telling me that there's something wrong? It's not perfect? Then why am I buying it? If there's something wrong with it, I shouldn't buy it. He says, no. This is perfect. There's nothing wrong. The problem is going to be if you don't hem up the bottom, if you don't trim it, it's going to be a problem down the line. And he just can't wrap his head around that. He can't understand it. Are you telling me it's good or it's not good? If it's good enough, then it's good enough the way it is. And if it's not good, then I'm not buying it. He decides in the end he's going to buy it. He goes home, puts it out at the table, has this beautiful festive banquet, and he has a bunch of little children who are sitting at the other end of the table. And they're just totally disinterested in the whole conversation. They're not really following what's going on with the great guests that are there. And one of the kids is just very bored, and he starts playing with one of the fabrics, starts playing with one of the edges that's sticking out. And as he's doing it, he's pulling one string, he's pulling another string. You ever seen a kid do this, right? And as time goes on, before you know it, the entire fabric unravels. It all happens, why? Because one little string was pulled out of place, and once that was pulled out of place, he pulled the second one out of place, and then the entire fabric gets destroyed. And says the Dubna Maggid, that's what it means, V'haya ekev tishmu'un. Sometimes we are not mindful, we're not attentive to that little string that's sticking out. A small, modest, and what we believe is an insignificant act is something that can very quickly unravel a person's life entirely. And that is what the Gemara tells us. The Gemara says that in the beginning, when we have a fight with our evil inclination, it's the small things that really get us going. It's sometimes a small thing that we make a mistake about, which leads us to then realize, oh, I can get away with that. I'm going to try something bigger. If I can get away with that, I'll try something more significant. But it all starts with the small things. And then very quickly, the whole thing can unravel. Compiling or writing a resume is something that is a very uncomfortable task for many people. And sometimes you're asked to send a bio or a resume that is meant to sum up who you represent, what you're all about for people who don't know you. And it's hard to figure out what exactly should be included. I'm applying for a job. Which qualifications belong on there, which don't? I'm going to visit someone and they want to know who I am, who they're meeting with. I don't want to be arrogant, but at the same time, I do want them to appreciate and understand what I'm about. Do I put all of my personal and professional accomplishments on there? How do I stick it on one piece of paper? It's a skill. It's an art to do that. But imagine if we were tasked with the exercise of compiling a resume for the Ribono Shel Olam. Imagine if we were asked to write what the essence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all about. Somebody came to you and said, what is God all about? Tell me. I'm new to the religion. I'm new to this belief. What would you say? How would you answer that question? It would be impossible. I wouldn't have enough pages in a book to answer that question. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Which aspect of the Ribono Shel Olam would you choose to accent? Which aspect would be highlighted? And how would you figure out, well, we should recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu for this and not for that? It would be a very, very difficult job. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu presents himself in the Torah as the Osa Mishpat Yasam Ve'amana, as the one who is always exacting in punishment for somebody who neglects the Yasam Ve'amana Ve'ohev Ger Lasis Lo Lechem Esimla. It's not beneath HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give his attention to other people that are being ignored. That is not at all beneath the dignity of the Ribono Shel Olam. There are people who are not valued enough in our community, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I will do whatever I can to fiercely defend the ones who are disadvantaged or the ones who have an ill fate. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, it's not beneath me. He does not define himself as the one who is Borei Shemayim Va'aretz. He does not define himself as the one who did all the Eser Makos, who performed the miracles of Kriyas Yamsuf. All of that is amazing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu refers to himself as the one who keeps a watchful eye on sometimes aspects of life that are so often ignored. So we'll move on to another point, and that is, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Gimel, I have a lot to talk about, just telling you. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Bava Metzia, how long did you budget to be here today? So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Bava Metzia, an amazing comment, that we actually recite every Rosh Chodesh. Tashas Choshech Vihi Laila. This is a comment from a pasuk in Sefer Tehillim, where we're told that there's something very dark about the world that we live in, about the world that we inhabit. And the Gemara asks, what is that a reference to? What's dark about the world that we live in? Now, unfortunately, we don't need any interpretation. Look around in the news every single day, and yeah, it's a pretty dark world. It's pretty awful. But there's lots of good going on in the world as well, don't forget. I'm a positive person. I see things in a positive light. The world is an amazing place. And as much as you read the news and you say to yourself, is there anybody normal left in the world? Is there anybody upstanding and moral and good anymore? And you say, look around, I have plenty of good friends who are actually good, who are doing the right thing, who help contribute to society in positive ways. Okay, the news only chooses to highlight all the terrible things. But there's lots of good going on in our community and all over the world. So what does it mean? Tashas choshech vihi laila. So the Gemara says, Zeh ha'olam hazeh shadoma l'laila. This is a reference to the world that we inhabit that is so disorienting. It's just dark. It's sometimes very confusing. I mentioned before what's going on in the news. I am deeply confused. Here you have somebody, 22 individuals came forward to give testimony about an individual who did horrific things, and yet hundreds if not thousands of people just showed up to this man's funeral. I can't understand that. It's very confusing to me. To me, that's a very dark world. That's a very hard thing to wrap my head around. I don't understand it. So that's what the Gemara tells us, that ha'olam hazeh doma l'layla. Sometimes our experience of this world is very dark, it's very confusing, and we have a hard time really understanding it. The Gemara in Pesachim tells us a story about Rabbi Yosef Bered and Rabbi Shua ben Levi. Rabbi Shua ben Levi had a son whose name was Rabbi Yosef, and the Gemara says on one occasion he got very sick, so much so that he came to the point where he died. And you've heard these stories before where somebody claims that they die and then they come back to life. I don't know if they exist or not, but the Gemara does describe such a thing, that Rabbi Yosef actually died, and then someone resuscitated him and he came back to life. And everybody was crowding around him. They couldn't believe the miracle that they were seeing. And they asked him, so what did you see? You were dead for a couple of minutes. Tell me, what did you see? Right? So Charlene Aminoff tells us what her daughter saw. Anybody ever heard her story? She's amazing. An amazing story. So she describes exactly what her daughter saw. I don't know how accurate it is. I have no idea. But the Gemara here says, they asked, what did you see? Let us know. She turns back and says, I'll tell you what I saw. Amar lei olam hafil ra'isi. I actually saw an upside down world. The entire world was upside down. Elyonim lamata v'tachtonim lamala. You see the garbage man, the homeless, who was walking around the town, picking through the garbage to find something to eat? He was actually like on top of the world over there. And all those people, all those politicians who are in the news every single day, who everybody's celebrating, giving millions of dollars for their campaigns, they're nothing. They're nobody. They don't even rate. Nobody's paying attention to them. Everything's upside down. And that, says the Gemara, is what it means, that we live in an experience of an olam hafuch, of an upside-down world, and so often you see that it's true. So often you ask yourself, am I crazy, or is the whole world crazy? I can't understand this. It doesn't make sense. Anybody else ever had that question? You read something, and you ask yourself, am I nuts? Am I nuts? Or is everybody else around me crazy? And that's what the Gemara says, that he goes up to heaven and he sees, you're not wrong, you're not nuts. The world has gone mad. It's an olam hafuch ra'isi. There's such an amazingly powerful story. It's illustrated so beautifully in the Sefer Gesher HaChaim. Gesher HaChaim is actually a three-volume Sefer that was written by one of the Gedolim of Yerushalayim in the last 100 years. Rabbi Chiel Michel Tukachinsky. I don't know if you've ever heard of him or not, but it is the authoritative Sefer on all issues regarding Avelis. So it talks about how you do a Tahara, how you bury someone, where they're supposed to be buried, how you go through the Shiva, the Shloshim, Yud Beis Chodesh, every single halacha you can ever think of. So in the introduction to this book, he has such a powerful mashal, where he says, it later on became a song. I think Journeys made a song about it. It's actually a very powerful song also. So the mashal that he gives is that there were twins who were in utero. And they're big philosophers, and they're having conversations, discussions back and forth. And he describes how they're in the midst of a philosophical debate, but at the same time, they're in a very sheltered, beautiful, pleasant environment, and it's the ideal life. Everything's perfect. What can be bad? We don't have to do anything. It's quite warm in there, not like here. And they're being taken care of, and every day when they're hungry, somehow they get fed, and it's just great. It's amazing. And what could be more perfect? What can be more beautiful than that? And finally, they get into a conversation. One turns to his brother and he says, you know, not sure why, but something's telling me that this is not going to be our existence forever. It just can't be. His brother says, what are you talking about? There is nothing else in the world. This is it. And he turns back to his brother and he says, no, I really believe that we have a limited existence here. We are confined to a certain time period, but at some point, this is going to come to an end. And his brother says, it's just impossible. To which he responds, look out in the world, there are so many people, and I really think that at some point, we're going to be out there, and we're going to see different colors. It's not just going to be dark like it is in here. There's going to be night and day. There's going to be sunset and sunrise. And we're going to look outside at a beautiful sky, and we're going to see all kinds of animals. And we're going to live in beautiful homes, and we're going to drive cars. His brother says, you're insane. What else do you imagine? He says, there's going to be lots of things to eat, different kinds of food. What do you mean different kinds of food? This is perfect what we have. We get everything we need. We're going to have all kinds of appliances in our homes. And then things are going to break. We're going to have to call fix-it workers to come and all kinds of companies. We're going to have to water the grass. We're going to have to cut down the trees. And all the amenities of life. Life is not going to be black and white. It's going to be very colorful. And he's hysterical at his brother. He says, you're out of your mind. You're really crazy. I think I'm going to call the doctor. You've become psychotic. You're insane. And one fine day, the woman goes into labor. And slowly, one of these children starts leaving the womb. And his brother is screaming, my brother's dying. I can't believe it. What's going to be? My whole existence is coming to an end. I thought that we were going to be brothers forever. And look what's happening. Meanwhile, on the other side, his brother's crying because when a baby is born, they begin to cry when they're trying to gasp for air. And he hears his brother crying and he says, you see, I knew it. I knew that he died. That's why he's crying so much. His brother on the other end says, wow, this is such an amazing world. I can't believe what I'm seeing. This is really what life is about. I was living in that dark existence. I had no idea what real life was, what people look like, what a room could look like, what people can feel like, what a hug and a kiss would feel like, what an embrace from somebody else, what some love would mean. I never knew what that was. Look what my brother's missing out on. What a fool that he doesn't want to come out to this existence. And back and forth, they're each laughing at the other. And he's crying over the fact that his brother has died and his existence is over. And his brother is crying over the fact that his younger brother has no understanding, has no way to fathom what he's about to experience. The Gesher HaChaim explains that so often this is what it means that we live in a dark world. Tashas choshech v'yihi laila. The world is very confusing. And he says, it's as confusing as those twins who are each looking at each other with disdain and with shock and horror, that you don't have any understanding what life is all about. So we live life and we do all kinds of things and we're involved in all kinds of projects and we build our homes and we drive our cars and we're building communities and we're doing all kinds of things and we think this is real life. And we are totally convinced that the people that we value are really the most valuable people in the eyes of God. And we think that we got it all right. And we are just as distant of a reality from what real life is as those two brothers who can't even fathom, who can't even begin to imagine what real life is. Ha'olam hazeh doma lelaila. Yes, it's very confusing. It's sometimes very chaotic. But that's the way it is. It's an olam hafach. The world is upside down. And sometimes we need to experience that. The Mor Nebuchim, which is a sefer in Hashkafa, written by the Rambam, he describes the difficulty that we have sometimes in understanding the Darkei Hashem. And there's no greater way to accent that than looking at this week's Parsha, at all these Parshias. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to redeem the Jewish people. I'll bring you to Eretz Yisrael. This is the way to be redeemed. This is the road toward redemption. How can that be? We have to go through a Sheba in Mitzrayim. We have to go through so much suffering and so much difficulty. It doesn't make sense. How many times have I spoken to young couples who say, you know, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to have a child, this is the road to my redemption. This is what I have to do. A young person who wants a shidduch, who's trying everything, this is my road to redemption. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me. It can't be. I said it over Friday night. I don't know who was here. But the Netziv has an amazing comment in this past week's Parsha. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu is trying desperately to get himself out of being the leader of the Jewish people. He doesn't want it. And he understands, it seems that most of this was really because of his own humility, but he really does not want to be a part of this at all. And he gives all kinds of excuses and all kinds of reasons why he's not relevant for this position. And he says, I'm a kavad peh, I'm a kavad lashon, I'm not a good orator, I don't know how to speak, I don't know how to present myself, I'm not a politician, I'm not the right choice, this is just not me, try to find someone else. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, you are the right one, you're the one who I've chosen. Finally, Moshe Rabbeinu makes an attempt by saying something different. You know, I'm not going to focus on my deficiencies, I'm going to give you a different reason why it shouldn't be. Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Vehein lo yaminu li velo yishma'u b'koli." He says, I'm not going to be the one to save the Jewish people because the Jewish people are not going to believe that I am the one who was sent by you. Ki yomru, because they're going to say, "Lo nirai lecha Hashem." There's no way that God singled you out to be the one to save us from Egypt. And Moshe says, that's why I'm not going. Because nobody's going to believe that I was the one who was chosen to save the Jewish people. That's the comment of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now ask the Netziv, why would anybody doubt that God spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu? He seems like a credible person. Why wouldn't I believe him? When he comes and he says, I'm here on behalf of God himself, I'm the messenger, I'm the one who's going to save you, I'm going to take you out of Mitzrayim, we're going to go to Eretz Yisrael, we're about to become a nation. Why wouldn't you believe him when he says that? What does Moshe Rabbeinu mean when he says, V'hein lo ya'aminu li v'lo yishmu'u b'koli? Explains in Netziv, I'll tell you exactly what it means. And he says, in every generation we have the same phenomenon. He was describing the Shivas Tzion movement in the 1800s. There was a major debate at the time. There were groups of Jews who were leaving from Europe to move to Eretz Yisrael. It was extremely dangerous. There was not a good infrastructure in Eretz Yisrael at the time. We obviously did not have our own land, our own country. It was under the sovereignty of others. And this was a major debate. Should we be part of the Shivas Tzion movement, or perhaps it's not an appropriate time for this? When God wants us to go back, we'll go. And one of the claims that people had was, how is it possible we're going to be involved in a movement going back to Eretz Yisrael when the people leading the charge are Ovdei Avodah Zarah, are atheists, they don't believe in God, they're not Shomrei Shabbos, they don't keep kosher, they don't keep anything. They're going to be the ones to lead the charge back into Eretz Yisrael. How can that be? It just doesn't make sense. It's not the image that I had of what Geula is supposed to look like. That can't be. It's impossible. That just cannot be. And writes the Netziv, that so often, we have an image in our own minds of how things are supposed to play out. When we think about Geula, you imagine in your own mind what it's going to look like, what it's going to feel like, how that experience is going to be played out for all of us. And everybody has their own imagination of what that should or should not be. Says the Netziv, there are certain things that we make up in our mind that's certainly not going to be like this. That for sure is not going to happen. You know, I said Friday night, I've always known that my father is a great tzaddik, but as I get older, I realize more and more There are a number of individuals who will come into the Beis Medrash on any given day. Nobody makes appointments to talk to my father. They just walk in any time. And he just gives everybody the time of day. So some of the times people are coming to ask all kinds of questions, community issues. But some of the times people are coming in with the most insane conversations. Now I learned with my father Bechavrusa for 9 years. I heard all of this. I know what they come to talk about. And the amount of people who come to talk to him about how urgent the need is that they reveal themselves as the Mashiach. I've met a number of these people, and now I have the great privilege, since my father is so busy and not always available, I have the great privilege that I've gotten the Yerusha of many of these, who when they can't reach my father, they desperately need to call me to figure out, what do we do? You know, at Rav Schefter, we always discuss it with him, and now he's not available, what should I do? I am Eliyahu HaNavi, I am Mashiach. And I always think to myself, you know, I don't have any patience for you. I just hang up. But my father sat there for hours listening to you and explaining all your calculations of why this year and why me and why from this community, why it has to be and how many people we need to reveal ourselves. All these machinations. If you think I'm making it up, ask any of my siblings. They've all seen it. So all of this, I say to myself, maybe it's true that Mashiach is going to come today, but it's certainly not going to be you. I'm sure that it's not going to be you. Right, so we have something made up in our minds, an image, a picture, a vision of what we think the experience of Geula and Mashiach is going to look like. And then we have an image of what it's certainly not going to look like. And I can assure you, it ain't going to be you. That's for sure. You know, I once called my brother when I was so frustrated. We were actually in Camp Simcha. A guy calls me, it's right before Tisha B'Av, what do? I need to reveal myself. Your father's not available. I spoke to Reb David Feinstein. He told me to go to Reb Schefter. I said, thanks, Reb David. We appreciate that. So he's running in circles and he says, your father's in Israel, I can't get in touch with him. I called my brother, I was so just like going out of my mind listening to this. My brother said, so tell him, good, reveal yourself. We're all here, we're listening. Let's see what happens. We're ready. Send in your resume. He told him, my brother said, say to him, next time he calls you, send in a resume. We'll put it on the long list of people. We have a whole lot of people we got to look through. Not so simple it's going to be you. So writes the Netziv, everybody has, if you know my brother, you appreciate that that's him. So everybody has an image of what they think Geula is going to look like, or certainly what Geula is not going to look like. Says the Netziv, Moshe Rabbeinu had the same issue in his generation. The Jewish people all were looking forward to a Geula. They all believed that at some point they would be redeemed. But they said to themselves, there's no way it's going to be this person. He grew up in the house of Paro. Who even knows if he's Jewish? Who knows what the story is with him? He's dressed like an Egyptian. He wasn't even here with all of us. All this time that we were undergoing Shibud Mitzrayim, he wasn't a part of it. You think he's going to be the one to save the Jewish people? Yes, we want to go free, but it certainly ain't going to be him. There's no way he's going to be the Moshiach on Shal Yisrael. And writes the Netziv, that is what happened in every generation. When they think about redemption, when they think about Geula, everybody has an image, a picture. It's not always the way you think. It's not always based on your fantasies and your imagination. Sometimes, yes, maybe Shivas Tzion, writes the Netziv, is going to happen through a group of people who are atheists and anti-Torah and do not keep Shabbos and don't keep kosher. Who knows? Maybe God decided that they should be the ones to lead the charge back into Eretz Yisrael. Why? Who knows? And the Netziv says, look no further than the story of Ezra. The Jewish people go into exile for 70 years. They're kicked out of the land of Eretz Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised them after 70 years they're going to have the right to return. So Ezra is the Navi at the time. He tries to galvanize the Jewish people. And here he is, he feels he has enough to go back into Eretz Yisrael and to have a functioning society. He gets to the cusp of the border of Eretz Yisrael and he turns around and he says, one second, do we even have enough Kohanim and Levim to run a Beis HaMikdash? I'm not even sure. All those Kohanim in the group, raise your hands. Oh, we don't have enough. Okay, let's turn around. He goes back, grabs a couple of more people and he says, all right, now we're going to go into Eretz Yisrael. Says the Netziv, look through the Psukim, when they describe that story of Ezra, going back, leading the charge of Shivas Tzion, all the way back before the second Beis HaMikdash. Who was there with him? It says the lowest of the low came back with him. The archi parchi, the nobodies of town, who had nothing else to do. So they said, all right, Ezra has a movement, why, we'll go along with him. We have no business here, we have nothing to do here, so we may as well go there, do nothing there. These weren't the prominent members of society. This was not the leadership of the Jewish people. This was the lowlives who decided to go along with him. And yet, from that came the redemption. Writes the Netziv, it happens all the time. And I think it's an amazing comment of the Netziv on its own, But it plays out in so many different areas of life. I think about it all the time. Unfortunately, there are people who lose their jobs. There are people who are unemployed, and they think, when am I ever going to get a job? So much devastation, so much is being destroyed in my life. What's going to happen? And they start searching in the same sphere where they used to be. And how often have we heard that a job opportunity comes up that's not based on their skill set at all, and they're nervous, should I look into this, should I not? They never would have imagined working in such an atmosphere, working in such a company, doing such a job, and yet, as time moves on, they show themselves, that's where the Geula is, that's where my Yeshua is going to come from, that's okay. How often do you have a person who has made up in their mind exactly what kind of boy, what kind of girl I'm going to marry, and they're dead set on that. And then they expand their horizons, and you never know, maybe the Geula is going to come from something that looks totally different. Very different than the imagination that I may have had in my own mind. Very different than my fantasy, and that's okay. Harbe shluchim lamakam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has so many different ways, but it's an olam hazeh hadoma lalayla. So often, it's confusing. And we don't know exactly where to turn, because it's very hard for us to really understand what's right, what's wrong, what's up, what's down, what's proper, what's improper. It's not always so simple. The Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim, an amazing story about a person who lives on a remote island somewhere all by himself, him and his wife, and then they're blessed with a young child. And about 3 months into the child's life, unfortunately, the woman passes away. And the Rambam tells the story about how this child is being raised by his father and there's nobody else around. The kid has never seen anyone else in the world. And they're living a natural life, living off of all the herbs of the world and all the natural substances that they can find. And the Rambam tells the story how one fine day, the kid turns to his father and he says, how did I come into the world? I'm just curious. How did this happen? That fateful question that no parent wants to answer, right? So how did I get here? And the father turns to his son. He says, you know, you have a mother. He says, what are you talking about? He says, there was a third person in this family who's unfortunately no longer here. He says, that can't be. It's impossible. What does a mother mean? He says, well, I'm telling you, there are two kinds of individuals in the world. There are men and there are women. And men look one way and women look a different way. He says, what are you talking about? It's impossible. You're telling me there's another human being that looks different than the way we look? That can't be. God created them differently. And then he explains to his son, by the way, you were in your mother's womb for 9 months. Kid says, that's impossible. I mean, scientifically, I'm a smart kid. If you would put me into a plastic bag for 9 months, I wouldn't be able to breathe. You're lying to me. You're such a liar. It's impossible. And what did I eat? Yeah? You're telling me I was in the womb for 9 months? What did I eat for 9 months? How'd you get to my mouth? How'd you feed me? He says, no, you don't understand. There was an umbilical cord. Nutrients came in from your mother. Every time she ate something, it went directly to you also. What? How can that be? You're telling me that my body was open from an umbilical cord? Well, how did my blood not all stream out of the body? How did my insides not come out? How can that be? You're telling me that I breathed when I was in a plastic bag. You're telling me that somehow I ate when I was in there and survived. And then you're telling me that somehow I came out? How did mom's entire stomach not come out at the same time? How did her lungs not fall out together with me? I mean, that doesn't make sense. This is impossible, this description that you're giving. And the father says, look, I understand that your arguments are logical, they're rational, it's true. When you look around at any other aspect of life, you're right. This doesn't match up with that. It doesn't really make sense. It's true. When you put somebody in a plastic bag, Rahman al-Itzlan, they can't breathe. And it's true, if you don't eat with your mouth for a certain number of days, you're going to die. Yeah, we understand that. But I don't know how to explain this. This is an amazing phenomenon. It's a miraculous phenomenon. Yes, there is something in the world called a woman. You don't know what it is, but I'm telling you, just trust me. There is something that is absolutely miraculous called childbirth. And just take my word for it that this is true. And the Rambam says, as much as you try to explain this to a child who just doesn't understand it, who has no way to wrap his head around this, it's just beyond his intellect. It's something he could never appreciate or understand as much as you try to explain it in simple terms. It's just not going to make sense. He's never seen such a thing in his life. And he doesn't know how to contextualize it. It just can't make sense to him. Says the Rambam, so often we try to understand things and we don't realize that it's infinitely beyond our understanding. And as much as you ask yourself, well, but this just doesn't make sense. It can't be. And this really doesn't match up to the way I thought it should. The Rambam says, sometimes we need to submit ourselves to the fact that yes, it is something that is so beyond our understanding. And that is unfortunately the world that we sometimes inhabit, that it's so confusing and so difficult. So you ask yourself, how is this ever going to work itself out if the world is so confusing? We daven for Mashiach. What's going to happen when Mashiach comes? You think God himself can even figure this out? It's so confusing. It's so complicated. So there's a beautiful comment of the Chafetz Chaim where he writes, think back 2 weeks ago to the story of Yosef HaTzadik and his brothers. And it gets very complicated as the psukim go through the unfolding of the story. And the brothers are so mystified. They're so confused. How does the viceroy of Egypt know how many members of the family we have? How does he know? And why did it happen that somebody has a cup in his bag? I mean, we're not Ganoven. We don't steal things. We're certainly not dumb enough to steal from the king of Egypt. How did this happen? What's going on? So many parts of this are just so confusing to them. And they're all probably having conversations on their way home. Does anyone understand this? Can anyone make sense of this? And they're fighting and all kinds of conspiracy theories and trying to figure it out. How does it become clarified? How does all of that story of Yosef and his brothers and the whole saga of them coming to Mitzrayim, going back, going forth, this brother being taken away, that one negotiating, how does it all become clear to them? Two words. Ani Yosef. You have a million questions. Yosef stands up in front of his brothers and says, Ani Yosef. No questions anymore. Suddenly, in 1 second, everything just made sense. But we were just arguing for hours. We were trying to figure it out. There's nothing left to argue. It's so obvious. Ani Yosef. Once he says Ani Yosef, everything becomes abundantly clear. There's no room for discussion anymore. It's so obvious. Nobody has any questions. Writes the Chafetz Chaim, if you look around in the world and you ask yourself, how is it possible that anyone's ever going to work out all these problems? How is it possible that the world will ever become normal again? How could it be that we'll ever have an Eretz Yisrael that is safe without us having to worry when we walk down the street that maybe, Rahmana Litzlan, somebody's going to be murdered, that somebody's going to be stabbed? When are we ever going to live in a time where we don't have to worry about the threat from Iran? That who knows what's going on there? When is that ever going to be a time, a reality in our lives that we're not going to have to worry about cybersecurity? Of people destroying from within, people destroying from without? How is this world ever going to work itself out? Why is the world running the way that it does? It doesn't seem to make sense to us. And the answer, writes the Chafetz Chaim, is we have a million and one questions and we're justified for having those questions. And life is very complicated and life is sometimes very convoluted and hard to understand. You know how it's all going to be figured out? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to stand up in the end of days and say, Ani Hashem. Just like Yosef stood up and said, Ani Yosef. And suddenly the entire family was no longer bewildered. Nobody had any surprises anymore. It made sense. They look him in the face and they say, ah, now we get it. Everything that happened fits into this pattern of Ani Yosef. Writes the Chafetz Chaim, Be'achris Hayamim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu will stand up and say, Ani Hashem. And he'll look each and every one of us in the eye and say, Ani Hashem. Nothing's going to be confusing anymore. In 1 second, somehow, everything will just become abundantly clear. We don't even have any questions that we're left with anymore. And that, writes the Chafetz Chaim, is what we all look forward to. I have so much more to say, but I see that we're out of time. Is this of interest to continue next week? In some way? Okay.